This show may contain my tips for making money on Bitcoin. It won't. It also may contain explicit language, and it really might. It's Tuesday, March 19th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So why won't Donald Trump actually condemn the ideology that drives white supremacists to murder? Because he's obstinate and will never utter anything against self-interest. But there is the rub. Why does he think it's against self-interest to condemn a white national neo-Nazi type who gave him some, though not all, credit for mass murder? Any run-of-the-mill D-minus politician takes the opportunity to mouth the platitude and just be done with all the criticism. Representative Jim Banks was on CNN this Sunday with Jake Tapper. He said it was impossible for any president or any of us to denounce such evil sufficiently.
Well, likewise, I mean, Ambassador Brown was unequivocal in his condemnation of the hateful actions in New Zealand. And again, the president, what the president said yesterday over the past 48 hours, condemned the actions of this crazy, hateful individual. And that none of us can do enough. None of us can be emphatic enough in doing that ourselves. That's what I've done. I'm sure that's what each of your panelists today and you have done as well.
So anything Donald Trump would have said would have been insufficient. And yet, wasn't it necessary for him to say anything at all? He made no denunciations of the ideology whatsoever. Others have pointed out that there is no way for the president to do enough to satisfy his critics. So don't do anything. What's going on in Trump's mind is one of two things. One, I'm not going to give in to anyone telling me what to do. That's definitely going on. And two, I need my people, which may include white nationalists, to stick by me. So now I'm going to tell you why Trump is wrong. Not morally wrong, duh, we know that. But politically wrong. If Trump were to condemn the white nationalists as white nationalists, he would make all the non-white nationalists who want to tell themselves we support Trump and we're not white nationalists feel good about themselves. That group is a lot larger than the actual Klansmen, neo-Nazis, Gab/8chan members who are happy about the Christchurch killings. It's not about satisfying critics. It's about giving cover to your base, which is all he cares about. But this is an argument to actually tend to your base because your base wants to feel absolved for literal murderous racism. Secondly, if Trump were to say something, it might actually work, as in it might decrease the odds that the next mass killing happens. It might decrease the odds that the next maniac cites him for a deed done or contemplated. And that would be a good thing. Now, not just for humanity, duh. We know it's good for humanity, but it would be a good thing for Donald Trump if there are less mass killings. Even if he digs his heel in non-apology mode, it doesn't mean he actually thinks that mass killings carried out by fans of his are good for his presidency, good for his agenda, good for his image. Now, that's if he says something and it actually decreases the chances of the next one happening. What if he says something and it doesn't decrease the chances or doesn't sufficiently decrease the chances such that the next one doesn't happen? Well, let's take that scenario, right? So I'm doing a decision tree and I've just branched off. So let's take that scenario. So if he had said just the de minimis platitude that people want him to say, if he had said that and there's another killing in the future, he can say, wait a minute, I said the thing you wanted me to say. And still, there was a killing. So it works out for him politically. Again, not morally. We can't talk about morals with this guy. So either way, denouncing white supremacy turns out to be good politics for him in the short term. No more horrific mass slayings. And he says, good, see, my words worked. Or more horrific mass slayings. And he says, see, it's not my literal words that are causing these people to do that. But he's obstinate. And he's also wrong. Not morally wrong. Come on, we know that. On the show today, I have a spiel about framing issues in the news. Is the glass half full? Is the glass half empty? Is the glass at its second lowest level since 2016? Is the water in the glass underrepresented in terms of the H and overrepresented in terms of the O? I guess not water then. The newspaper, by the way, which sets off this bit of opining, is the New York Times. Maybe you've heard of it. So up next, we have Jill Abramson, who was executive editor of that paper for 2.5 years. She has since moved on to a teaching gig at Harvard and is out with a book that looks at Facebook, Vice, BuzzFeed, The New York Times, and The Washington Post to see where journalism is going. We talk about her conclusions, allegations that she plagiarized, and if there is any actual way to make news pay. Jill Abramson's new book is Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. She is the former executive editor of The New York Times, and she has spent her time since leaving that august institution surveying the media landscape and figuring out what's going on with establishment media, with new media, where we might be going. With Donald Trump, we're going to talk about everything that her book talks about and some of the conversation about her book. Thanks for coming in, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
Are we sure that journalism that is sufficient to serve a community and journalism that is profitable can necessarily coexist in 2019?
No, we're not certain, Mike. And, you know, we're living during a time where there's a news desert. Local newspapers have hundreds of them closed. Others have been bought by vulture capital funds who strip out any of the good journalists. So not for local news, that's for sure.
This is my point and my concern. So in your book, you deal with four, maybe five, if you count Facebook, big media companies. And the legacy or establishment media are Washington Post, New York Times. They're doing well. But I wonder how replicable their lesson is if you're the Baltimore Sun or if you're the Indianapolis Star and if you used to have a local news hole of 12 pages and now it's two.
Well, you know, the business models of the Times and the Post really can't be adopted or adapted even by many other news organizations or newspapers, because to charge on the web and have digital subscriptions become a meaningful revenue stream, you have to produce news that is of such high quality and so singular that people are willing to pay.
Right.
And many regional and certainly local papers have cut so much that, you know, the value of the product has gone down. And so they're caught still dependent on advertising, which is shrinking very rapidly.
Well, I think, and I know you think from reading the book, that there are definitely a lot of cross currents. And one is that the strength of the newspaper pretty much existed on, if you want to be harsh about it, some market inefficiencies. They could charge so much for classified ads because there was no other way to tell people that your Corvette was for sale. And then Craigslist came along, and they're not horrible, terrible people. In fact, Craig Newmark is probably a force for good in this world. But, you know, they undercut and killed the classified ads, which, by the way, were probably charging consumers usury rates. But because of that, there's no funding for local stories. And now for stories to get money for internet advertising, they have to appeal to the World Wide Web, not just the people in, you know, Owings Mills, Maryland.
That's right. And, you know, the Times had already training wheels in doing that, because in the 1990s, they made a decision to push out nationally and become a national paper.
Right.
And when I was still there, the strategy was to be a global paper. And that is a successful strategy for the web. But the web is not a good place because it is global for very localized news.
Okay, so that's not a good thing that's going on.
No, I mean, yeah. I wish I had the magic solution. I don't think anyone does.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of really interesting experiments. I mean, ProPublica, which I'm on the advisory board of, just started a group that is going to supply great investigative pieces to precisely the kinds of news local newspapers that can't afford to do watchdog journalism anymore.
I love them because they're not only vital and informative, but the way they tell their stories is interesting. And so often with the good journalism projects, that is pushed down the list. I think journalism, to be great journalism, has to be interesting journalism.
I agree. And I was determined in my book to make it a narrative that moved and had tantalizing and interesting things that would push the reader along.
Yes, it worked. Now, were you was it hard for you to write the part where you were offering solutions for this industry where it seems that quite clearly we have to be honest and say, I don't know if there's a solution.
And there isn't one business model that will work for everybody. But, you know, I found that vexing. I certainly hoped a solution would be found or I would find one during the 3 years I worked on the book.
Do you think that BuzzFeed and Vice are succeeding because they're cutting out large parts of the audience? In other words, maybe older people, maybe people who aren't going to thrill to or will mean nothing to them if their correspondent has, you know, face tattoos, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, they both cater to a younger audience. But I think that both of them have smart news strategies. I mean, they, even though both have become very expensive news operations, they're selective about what topics they go really deep on. And, you know, BuzzFeed was very early on to sexual harassment on campuses and did great work. And, you know, Vice was on to, you know, the importance and horror of white nationalist hate groups very early. And BuzzFeed was onto the fake news story, you know, in, before the election, one of the few.
Right. And do you think that maybe those organizations aren't held to the same standards? In fact, let's stipulate, they're not. The BuzzFeed story about Trump directing Cohen to lie, it's the only thing that's been rebutted by the Mueller commission. Let's say the New York Times was the only institution ever to elicit a formal rebuttal from the Mueller commission. Don't you think the consequence would be worse for the Times than it's been for BuzzFeed?
Yes, it would be, you know, a major story picked up by every other news organization, maybe out of Schadenfreude.
And it's and we should say it's not just because BuzzFeed is what BuzzFeed is. McClatchy, which is much more staid and traditional, also had a story about Cohen being in Prague that hasn't been confirmed by any other news source.
Right.
Very, very analogous to the BuzzFeed situation. Based on that, I agree. Do you think that there is a problem with the Times in that they know they're so punished for mistakes that it prevents them, the culture, individual journalists, from going out on the ledge as much as they should?
Well, I write in the book about one particular story that was before the election, and it was the Times was criticized for not giving equal scrutiny to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump because their scoop was Hillary's private email server, and then, you know, they went to town on that story. They did quite a few good investigative pieces on Trump, but they were, you know, from the convention period on, you know, approached by, you know, the opposition research investigative firm that was involved in producing the dossier. And they were trying to confirm many of the things in it and couldn't. You know, they did not publish that story. And their public editor then, months after the election, said they'd been too timid.
I think the bigger, this is after your tenure, I think the bigger complaint about the Times wasn't the dog that didn't bark, but it was the incessant yapping about, oh, the emails,
the
oh, the emails.
And I think, and I'm very critical of that in the
book. I think it's legitimate, and yet at the same time, I've covered politics not as much as you have, maybe. There has never been a time when the followers, the biggest fans of a losing candidate, didn't blame the media for their defeat.
Right.
You know, the Kucinich people would come hard at me.
I would never say the Times coverage defeated Hillary Clinton.
No. And when Comey makes his remarks, you got to put it on the front page. But there was the emails.
Right. Yeah. And that front page was completely dominated with huge pictures, too.
But listen to us, the front page. What percentage of Americans are
was dominated by it, almost as if it was another Watergate.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
And it wasn't. Right. It just wasn't.
Yeah, it was maybe a travel gate or a file gate. Remember that one?
Yeah, I do.
That was big. So I want to talk about the charges of plagiarism, which are 6 or 7 passages in the book closely resemble to, in certain phrases, I don't even know, full sentences, maybe exact replications of previous work. And I do believe in almost all those instances, you did footnote the original work, but you didn't make clear that you were taking phrases. Do you have contrition for what happened?
I have contrition for it. You know, the book is a long book. It's 500 pages. There are 70 pages of footnotes. Mm-hmm. And there are 835 credit citations. And there should have been more clear, you know, another 7, let's say. Or those phrases should have been just quoted in the book. That becomes awkward in writing narrative nonfiction, to always be using news language according to. But, you know, I wish I had in a few of those cases.
You did change the gender identity of one of the people you described, right?
In the book, I have it absolutely correct.
Right.
And I corrected it proactively myself, realizing I had made a mistake from the galley.
Yeah.
Galleys are label uncorrected proofs.
Right.
But it's right in the book.
Right.
And in the case of these other passages, I've, you know, quoted and cited the source and had proper footnotes.
Yeah. And so let me just say, I've done a lot of reporting on this myself. I contacted many of the people many of the original writers whose work you cited. I didn't hear back from all of them. The ones I did hear back from did not want to go on the record, but I will convey the general impression I got from at least a few of them, which was, it's fine. And to them, it wasn't a horrible offense.
Well, then why did Michael Moynihan go on, you know, CNN's Reliable Sources and, you know, made it sound
well,
like—
For a couple reasons. First of all, maybe he didn't contact. All maybe he did was look up the source, look up what you said, and said the phrases matched up. Second of all, it should be noted that it shouldn't be up to the victimized party to absolve the victimizer, if we want to call you that. And maybe third of all, the transgression of plagiarism is a transgression against the original writer, but it's also a transgression to the reader. So if the original author says no big deal—
as many of them as I had contacts for, and that was most of the 7.
And
some were still furious and cared a lot, and some didn't.
Yes, that was that.
But
was
all of them appreciated that I said I was sorry and I was going to correct it.
If someone did this very similar transgression who was under your supervision, what would the punishment be at the Times?
Probably an editor's note in the paper, a strong talking to, and you'd be watching their work.
Yeah. And you would try to take into account the intent.
Yeah, I would. Absolutely. Yeah. One of the English professors, who is a colleague of mine, I teach in the English department at Harvard, sent me a note like the second this blew up, and he said, "What you did is venial, not venal."
Right.
And that makes a huge difference. It's not, you know, plagiarism.
It's venal and not a mortal sin, I would say, too. So let me ask you this, and you don't have to. This is just a thought I had.
Okay.
I think that some of the way this played out, we have the 500 pages of your book. We have a really cogent argument. We had reviews that I think
were great.
Were great before anyone knew about this. So there's this body of work. Let's pay attention to this work. And then we have legitimate enough complaints of a bunch of instances of not crediting work. The amount of attention that was paid to the second part of it, to the transgressions that Vice amplified, has disproportionately affected your book.
Well, that was the intent. And that's
well, not
why,
only was it the intent.
That's why it started on Twitter. Twitter is
yes.
the ignition system for news.
But my
now.
Question is, isn't that entirely an analogy of exactly what
yes.
you're writing about?
I felt like I was living through exactly what I wrote about in the book, how things go viral so quickly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you when you're in the middle of one yourself and the focus of it, you know, you feel horrible, like you'll never be able to hold your head up again. But like any viral piece of news, it's like here today and then it quiets down.
Do you think the gravitational pull of that takes the book with it?
No.
That the whole thing is now down the memory hole. Oh, that was the book with the plagiarism.
No, I think that this book, which the FT called a masterwork, is going to stand the test of time and have a long life.
Yes, except for the fact that the media is changing so quickly, it might be this fun relic. Hey, remember we thought that Vice and BuzzFeed were on the cutting edge. Last question, where do you think podcasting fits in this whole new media ecosphere?
It's the new hot thing. Listening to something interesting is the best. So, you know, many podcasts are incredibly good. At Slate, I know he's getting back up, but I miss Leon. I was like a huge slow burn addict. Well, so, yeah, they're the new shiny thing.
Well, let me ask you, Fiasco, his new show, is coming out on Luminary, but it's subscription. Analogy with the news business.
Will
you know,
people pay?
Right. So newspapers were criticized for giving it away for free at first. Now, in my industry, podcast, there's this backlash. How can you ask people to pay what we're giving you for free? It's not free. It's advertising. Is there a better or worse way to do it?
I think if you're making really a really great thing, you ought to charge for it.
And that is why Jill Abramson's Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts is available for, oh, look, I'm seeing $19.49 now on Amazon. That is called a shameless plug. Are you okay with that from a journalistic perspective, Jill?
I'm grateful as a writer, yes.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. The New York Times is the best newspaper in the country. Even if you don't believe it's the best, it's hard to argue with the idea that it is the most influential. All of the cable shows, all the public radio, all the websites are largely influenced by the content that the New York Times focuses on and what it points to and what it says is important. It's as much an agenda setter as we have in this country. Now, the New York Times gets it wrong. Of course it does. We all do. The New York Times has biases insofar as it's made up of people. And sometimes the biases mislead the people or allow the writers and editors to mislead themselves. I don't think it's prevalent. You might. That is not the point of why I'm saying all this. The fact is there are humans with biases making the paper. And this gives rise to what I want to talk about. So the worldview of the Times affects the framing of issues in the paper. This is true for all papers, this is true for all outlets, this is true for anyone who disseminates information. There will be an event, and you will give that event a frame because you're trying to do a favor for your readers or listeners or audience to tell them what it means, how it fits in to how they see the world. And in doing so, you're kind of telling them how you see the world, even a little subconsciously. Two recent examples. So, a couple weeks ago, the Oscars. Here was the headline in the New York Times. Seamless ratings for hostless Oscars. Other media pretty much agreed. Deadline had a story. 2019 Oscars ratings. ABC gets boost over 2018 with hostless show. The Atlantic, the Oscars and ABC got their ratings boost. And Variety, Oscars 2019 ratings rise from last year to 29.6 million. Now, from my perspective, I was a little upset with the fact that the Oscars didn't have a host. I'm not a huge fan of Kevin Hart, but I like comedy. I like comedians. I also don't like the fact that we'd be going through someone's past as if we were opposition researchers in a rival political contest. We found an example of plagiarism while an undergraduate. Yes, Kevin Hart made years-old homophobic remarks in his comedy. By the way, those comedy bits were mean-spirited, and Kevin Hart isn't really that funny. He's definitely charismatic, more charismatic than funny, and his apology was lacking. It was more defensive than sincere. It was all imperfect all around. Still, I like having a host. I like having the host be funny. I don't love punishing transgressions of years past. And proof of how much a host is needed is when Maya Rudolph, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey came out, cracked some jokes, everyone loved it. But I guess America disagreed. Ratings were up. So I guess I was wrong. Only, let's read a little bit in terms of coverage. Seamless ratings for hostless Oscars, the New York Times. Who needs a host? For the first time in 5 years, the Oscars broadcast has growth in viewership. Now for the not so great news. While the Academy Awards show on Sunday, which honored Green Book for Best Picture, had 29.6 million viewers, a 12% increase from last year, it still attracted the second lowest viewership since Nielsen started keeping track of ratings in 1974. So how the Times covered it, many others, is ratings were up. They also put the fact that it was the first time in 5 years that there was a growth in viewership, but they could have also said, quite as accurately, second lowest rated Oscars ever. Okay, keep that in mind. Let's move to climate change. Here's a headline in the New York Times. 2018 was the fourth warmest year on record. NASA scientists announced Wednesday that the Earth's average surface temperature in 2018 was the fourth highest in nearly 140 years of record keeping. The data means that the five warmest years in recorded history have been the last five. Of course, it is equally true, just as a matter of pure fact, if you had said, for the second year in a row, the average global temperature dropped. 2016 was the warmest, and then it dropped in 2017, and then it dropped again last year. So back to the idea of frames. Why did the Times frame their climate change article in the way they did? I think they did so absolutely properly. So we wouldn't take away, oh, things are getting better. We would take away, if you get a little bit of a larger sample size, it's still terrible. But they didn't extend that to the Oscars because the frame there was no host, Oscars succeed. Now, all that in mind, I'm not even casting aspersions, going to motivation, just pointing it out that depending on how you see the world and how you think your viewers or readers want to see the world is how you present information. Here is the headline in today's Times. Front page, below the fold, two actual relics of an age when paper was on paper. It was also, we're going to talk about the phrase after the jump in a second. Here's the headline. Only seven black students got into New York's most selective high school out of 895 slots. This clearly is stark. It's an accurate statistic. It points to a problem. Here's the lead of this article. Only a tiny number of black students were offered admission to the highly selective public high schools in New York City on Monday, raising the pressure on officials to confront the decades-old challenge of integrating New York's elite public schools. None of this is good. I'm not going to argue that seven African-American students in a city that is a quarter black is acceptable or even understandable. Not 7%, 7, right? 7% would be 60-something students. We're talking about 7 total students. Kind of crazy to have a flagship public school to be such a bastion of whiteness. Here's the thing. It's not at all a bastion of whiteness. And it's not integrated. It's just not black or Latino. Stuyvesant High School, the flagship of the public schools, 75% Asian, which doesn't take off the table any of the problems that I've talked about that the article is clearly pointing to with the number of black kids just being 7. But it is interesting in that this issue does not cleave to the normal or what we've come to expect as the usual construct of white privilege, white supremacy. It doesn't even adhere to the usual contours of racism per se, as we experience in this country. Some statistics: public school students in New York City, 15% white, 16% Asian, 26% black, 40% Hispanic. It also makes me question some of the phrasing, other phrases in the article. Quote, these numbers come despite Mayor Bill de Blasio's vow to diversify the specialized high schools. Here's the Wall Street Journal headline. New York City's elite public schools admit a new class with little change in diversity. Well, yes, more black and Latino students would not only be necessary, it would literally make the schools more diverse. But, you know, white students would, too. You could literally double the number of white students and increase the number of black students by a handful, and the schools would be more diverse than they are now. Stuyvesant is literally not diverse because it's largely Asian, mostly Asian, very mostly Asian. It's not diverse in the same way that the NBA is not diverse. In fact, the numbers are really similar. In the NBA, 75% of players are African-American, 2 to 3% are Latino, and the rest are white, as many from Europe as from the U.S. But no one calls the NBA not diverse. It's welcomed as a tonic of diversity in our culture. The word integration is used in those stories differently than it's usually used. Here's a quote. New York City schools chancellor Richard Carranza, who has pushed for more integration, said these numbers underscored the need to eliminate the admissions exam, saying they showed, quote, an unacceptable status quo at our specialized high schools. Integration. There should be more black and Hispanic students, a lot more, but these schools aren't segregated. They're just integrated by Asians. Although maybe to be accurate at this point, you might argue they're integrated by white students who are integrating into predominantly Asian spaces. I have often thought of these notions when I think about the issue of diversity in tech, which is a big problem. Google and Facebook and Apple and Amazon, overwhelmingly male, horribly non-black, horribly non-Hispanic, but they're not white. They're much less white than America. Google has a workforce that's 2.5% black, 3.6% Hispanic, 53% white, and 36% Asian. And I just looked up the Apple stats, and they have it by new hires and overall representation. Asians represent 25% of new hires, 21% of overall representation. Whites are 43% of new hires and 54% of overall representation, less than the population at large. The tech companies use the phrase historically underrepresented minorities in tech so as to mean not Asians. And by the way, we're lumping together Asians in a little bit of a weird way, aren't we? Assyrians, not the same as a Filipinas, not the same as an Indian. That group, the three I named, that's a diverse group, not a non-diverse group. By the way, a lot more than half the world's population is Asian. Let's lump them all together in the name of pursuing diversity. It seems really at odds with itself. Look, here's the disclaimer part of this spiel. I understand, I acknowledge the idea of the Asian as model minority. I understand how that is a pernicious idea in our society. I also understand that just because Asians are doing well in these contexts, it doesn't mean that there's not racism that abounds in hiring and promotions and opportunities. I'm not saying anything of the sort. I also do think that the problem of the tech companies, which are shaping the world, is really, really important if you have a workforce that doesn't look like the society that you are, in fact, lording over. It's a little bit different than a top high school not reflecting its district. And again, I want to emphasize, the ethnic makeup of this one top high school is really a problem. It's just not the exact problem it's being treated as. Now we get to what to do, and this is where I really get frustrated. Because obviously the answer is, and this is never brought up in New York City, oh, we got to open more good high schools or more great high schools. This isn't building an extra tunnel under the East River. It's not adding a mile to the Q line, which costs $2.5 billion a mile. It's opening a high school. We do this every year. And we did it under Bloomberg. That practical-minded technocrat wasn't given to high-soaring rhetoric about race, and in fact was derided by progressives for his racial policies, but all that guy did was open 5 really top high schools, not as good as Stuyvesant, but he built 5 excellent high schools. They're educating a greater number of black and Hispanic students than the old high schools did. So again, I think there are solutions out there. I think that there are proper ways of framing the problem. And I think that when we use phrases like integration and diversity, and we use them kind of lazily and in a way that doesn't quite accurately describe the problem, well, then maybe we too fail the very rigorous exams we set for ourselves. And that's it for today's show that just was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader, who have been caught plagiarizing from Beyonce. Or is it possible that a couple of guys in their late 20s independently came up with the formulation, "Are you ready for this jelly?" Doesn't seem possible. Danielle Hewitt helped produce the show today. She is currently under fire from the staff writers of Vice, who said that she described them as having neck tattoos when they really have clavicle tattoos and extremely bad posture. TJ Raphael is senior producer of Slate Podcasts. We once said her boots were blue when in fact her boots were kind of a seafoam green, but also she's not wearing boots. She just has severe frostbite and needs to see a doctor immediately. The Gist. We wish to clarify, Jill Abramson described my hair as buzzed when she should have said bald to balding, or at least balder than Mr. Belding, the beloved character on Saved by the Bell, which she described as brain-rotting escapist basic cable comfort food, which is a formulation that also appeared in the June 1989 issue of TV Guide. We regret all the errors. Oompa-roo-dap-roo-doo-paroo, and thanks for listening.